I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast, and I'm seeing a lot of messages confirming that things sound great and people are excited to be here. Patrick, thank you for all the exclamation marks. We're glad to have you here too. And so with that gentle reminder, I think we're ready to turn it over to one of your very first speakers, Emmy Laiha, to provide some opening remarks. So Emmy, let me turn the floor to you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this webinar called Rods and More at Federal Facilities. A lot of the information is not specific only to federal facilities, but we do discuss some of the nuances that come with our federal facility NPL sites. So we're hopeful that you'll be able to come away with a better understanding of how CERCLA is implemented at those federal facilities on the NPL. In just a bit, we'll go over the Federal Facilities Academy and how you can gain credit for taking this webinar and the other 10 webinars, as well as an in-person course to be able to get a certificate of completion for the Federal Facilities Academy. This is voluntary training, but we really want to, and when I say we, I should identify the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters, which is where I work. We really want to acknowledge folks who are taking that extra effort to understand these nuances and help standardize our implementation of CERCLA at federal facility sites. So, thank you for being here. I'd like to hand it back over to Jean to talk a little bit more about the details on how to obtain credit for this course.
All right, thank you so very much, Emmy. So just a quick gentle reminder, as Emmy said, the Federal Facilities Academy is composed of several online webinars, which we've been delivering live through Cluin, just like today's session. All 11 of those webinars are open to the public and are available for on-demand playback after the live delivery. For each webinar, you'll have the opportunity to provide feedback and request a certificate of participation. So you can participate in any or all of the live online webinars. You can re-watch any of the recorded versions of those webinars. You can mix and match and participate these sessions in any mode that works for you. And in all cases, you can request an individual certificate of participation for each delivery, whether it was live or online, by filling out that feedback form and checking a box to request the certificate at the end of the form. And then, as Emmy highlighted, there will be a 3-day classroom training that is open to a limited audience of federal, state, and tribal regulatory agencies. And if you qualify and are able to take that 3-day in-person class and also have completed all of the online webinars, whether live or online, you'll then receive the Academy Certificate of Completion, indicating that you've participated in all components of the training. If you have any questions on your certificates or your status, you can feel free to contact me directly. Emmy, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, thank you so much.
Here we go. Emmy, that was me. Let me click this back to this. And now I turn the floor to you.
Thank you. Now, much appreciated, Jean. So, thank you, everyone. Again, my name is Emmy Laiha. I am with the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters, and we're very happy to be bringing you this webinar today. I'd like to allow my other instructor to introduce themselves. If I could invite Cal to come on camera and give a little bit of background about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Emmy. My name is Cal Bayer Anderson, and I work with Emmy in the Federal Facilities Superfund program. I'm happy to be here today. I love talking about the challenges and opportunities that come with working on these very complex and challenging sites. So look forward to talking with you more.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cal. So before we get into the content for today's webinar, we'd like to learn a little bit more about the folks that we have joining us today. So with this group poll, we'll learn a little bit more about you. Jean, can you take them through the poll, please?
Absolutely. So in this case, I'm going to ask you to read the question that's on the screen and share your written response by sending a message in through the Q&A. So I'll start summarizing the messages as I see them appear in the Q&A. And let's just read through this question here. So everyone starts from the same frame. We're going to ask each of you to think, what types of cleanup decisions have you been involved with as part of the CERCLA process? So maybe you were involved with a ROD, a record of decision, a ROD amendment, an ESD, removal actions. Perhaps there were others. So we'll ask you to click that Q&A button, type in your individual response. You can list as many of the cleanup decisions that you've been involved with. And if you've never been involved in one, perhaps you're new to all of this and you haven't done anything, you can also put that in and say you haven't done that yet. So, Emmy, as I'm scrolling through some of these responses, a lot of people have worked on RODs. Several people have indicated they have done all of the above. Some are saying they haven't done any. They're brand new to EPA. Another one that seems to be really prominent are ROD amendments, but I'm seeing some other items such as RIFS, 5-year reviews. I'm seeing individuals who have time-sensitive removal activities, CERCLA allocations, some corrective actions, a new acronym, RIWP addendums. So we've got a variety of responses here, but without a doubt, the ROD and ROD amendments seems to be the top responses.
All right, that's great. So we have a lot of different experience from the folks joining us today. And luckily, we'll be touching on almost all of those documents in today's webinar. So let's go ahead and get started. We'll be looking at, as I mentioned before, the CERCLA process being implemented at federal facility sites that are on the National Priorities List, the NPL. We'll also talk about, through that process, removal actions, record of decisions, interim RODs. And what about those changes that happen after a ROD is issued through an explanation of significant difference or a ROD amendment? And we'll sum everything up with looking at how 5-year reviews can have impacts on decision documents. So let's go ahead and jump into it. We really want to see how can these different cleanup decisions complement each other? How can we use those early actions and removal actions to help get us closer to implementation of a remedial action, with the ultimate goal of getting deleted from the National Priorities List, acknowledging that those 5-year reviews may need to continue into the future in essentially perpetuity. So let's go ahead and jump into it. General introduction to CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. I know we've used the acronym a lot, but hadn't spelled it out quite yet. Also known as Superfund, was passed in 1980. And then the amendments to that were passed in 1986. And that authorizes the president to respond to releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances into the environment. When you actually read the language of what a release is, it covers everything under the sun. A spill, a drop, there's a whole list of different adjectives about what a release could be. So essentially trying to be very, very comprehensive in what could be addressed under CERCLA. Another important part of implementation of CERCLA at federal facilities is Executive Order Number 12580. So in this executive order, it identifies other federal agencies that can serve as the lead agency at a federal facility NPL site. So we'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. Just wanted to keep in mind that lead agency is a term you'll hear very often when we're talking about federal facility cleanups. And when it comes to that Executive Order 12580, it essentially gives presidential authorities under CERCLA to the heads of other executive branch agencies in specific circumstances. So let's take a look at what those are. Again, with the National Contingency Plan, the specific details on what the lead agency is included there. So when you talk about the lead agency, they are the ones who are providing on-scene coordinators and remedial project managers. So sometimes you think, oh, EPA has RPMs, they're the lead agency. Actually, no. For most of our sites, those that are Department of Energy sites, Department of Defense sites, the lead agency is that other federal agency. DOD and DOE have the largest number of federal facility sites. They're identified as the lead, but there are instances for sites other than those of EPA, the Coast Guard, DOD, or DOE, then that other federal agency will be the lead agency for remedial actions and for any removal action not considered an emergency. So just some specifics there on what lead agency means. When we're looking more closely at CERCLA and federal facilities, Section 120 is specific to federal facilities. It actually has some additional requirements that have to be met. The biggest point I want to make here is that at federal facilities, they are subject to the same requirements as, or to the same extent of cleanup as at private entities are. There's no special treatment or more laxed approaches for federal facilities. CERCLA still needs to be implemented. In fact, the language in Circular 120 says that federal agencies have to comply with all of the guidelines, rules, regulations, criteria, and shall not adopt guidelines that are inconsistent with those that are established by the EPA administrator. So that phrase, guidelines that are inconsistent, comes up quite a bit in our discussions between EPA and other federal agencies, where you might have another federal agency saying, oh, well, our internal guidance states that this is how we do things. Well, if that internal guidance to that agency is inconsistent with EPA guidance, then essentially it can't be referenced or it can't be used to justify a part of the CERCLA process being implemented at that site. We hear that a lot. There's definitely a lot of conversation about what inconsistent entails. Another part of CERCLA 1, Section 120, is that individuals and states can essentially sue if it's determined the lead agency is not following CERCLA, implementing it again to the same extent as at private entities at federal facilities. And one last thing I want to identify here, when it comes to selecting a remedy, I have heard a bit of, I don't want to call it confusion, but maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding that, oh, that is the lead agency's remedy or the lead agency selected the remedy. In reality, it's EPA as the lead regulator, federal regulator, excuse me, and the federal agency jointly selecting remedies. But EPA, through its presidential authority, is the ultimate selector of the remedy in the event of a dispute at the site for federal facilities. So, the way I sum that up in a way that's easy to understand is that you can't have a record of decision at a federal facility NPL site without EPA signature. So, a lead agency can't just issue a ROD and say, well, this is what we're going to do. EPA has to be party to that. And very typically, the state also will sign off on that based on the federal facilities agreement for that site. Excuse me. So I've talked a lot about CERCLA and what that the requirements that are described there, but I want to take a second to talk about the NCP, the National Contingency Plan, which essentially acts as the regulatory blueprint for how CERCLA will be implemented, giving those step-by-step processes for conducting both removal actions and remedial actions. So these are available online. You can get the most current version by going to these links. These should also be in your participant manual and that PDF that Jean mentioned, so you can easily click on them, and access that latest version of the NCP. We also included links to the preambles, which have some important information, for your reference as well. But this is the blueprint, right? That we have the requirements in CERCLA, and then we have the blueprint here in the NCP, the step-by-step processes. This figure here is essentially a very high-level flowchart of the CERCLA process. It focuses more on the remedial side, but we do mention removal actions. I'm going to attempt to turn on my laser if I have one. Do I have a laser, Jean? I may not.
I will get a laser pointer on for you, Emmy. Bear
Okay.
with me. We will get that so you can see the yellow arrow. Will this work for you?
I don't see it, but that's okay. No worries. I'll just talk us through this. Okay. So for the CERCLA remedial process, going from beginning to end, we start with first discovery and notification of that release of essentially this release has happened. Is this actually going to move forward to be a site that is placed on the NPL? So we have a separate training on the federal facilities docket for more information on that specific process. But after notification is given, a preliminary assessment is made to determine if there's sufficient risk for this site to continue to move forward. Once that happens, we can do a risk hazard analysis to get to the listing on the national priorities list. If the risk is high enough, then it'll be placed on the NPL. However, any time in between that notification and placing on the NPL, the contamination at a site may be addressed by a removal action under the authority of the lead cleanup agency or a voluntary cleanup program, other type of state program. There are some off ramps for these sites that are identified or the contamination that's found at these locations. Let's say that a site does present a high enough risk that it is placed on the NPL. So once that occurs, a remedial investigation and feasibility study needs to take place. So that we'll begin with a work plan on how to conduct that activity, and then a report will be written with that information. And again, there might be some contamination that off-ramps and is addressed by a removal action if it makes sense to do so. Once the RIFS is complete, and I'll just mention here, for some of our larger, more complex sites, an RIFS may take 5 years to complete. It's not usually just one field season and you can write the documentation. It takes a lot of information, especially for our more complex sites. So once you have your RIFS complete, we go to that proposed plan, which is issued for public comment. From there, once you go through the public comment process, we write a responsiveness summary, get all of that together, you can actually issue your record of decision. And keep in mind that the ROD might be an interim ROD, which we'll talk about more in a bit, or it may contain contingency remedies. So all of that we'll discuss in more detail. Once the remedy is selected, the ROD is signed, you can move forward with the remedial design and remedial action. There will be a work plan for that. Typically, you'll see, when I say you see, I'll say regulators may see a design at 30%, 60%, 90% as it's being developed until you have the full construction on that remedy complete. Depending on the cleanup requirements for that decision, if any waste is left in place that restricts use of that land, you know, there's not unlimited exposure or unlimited use for that resource, then 5-year reviews are required. And the 5-year review starts from the beginning of the remedial action, not at the completion of the remedial action's construction, just something to keep in mind. From there, often we have, especially for groundwater remedies, they go into operation and maintenance, which includes monitoring for many years. They can be very long-term cleanups, especially for groundwater, that are implemented. Ultimately, our goal is to get to the end of this little chutes and ladders flowchart to site closeout and ultimately site deletion. So that, in a nutshell, is about everything we're going to talk about in more detail in the rest of the webinar. I like to lay out the landscape, so to speak, so that we can see where we're going before we get there. Now we're going to go ahead and switch gears into removal actions. So with removal actions, there is specific language that states, to the extent practicable, removal actions shall contribute to the efficient performance of any anticipated long-term remedial action. So to the extent practicable can be a bit subjective, and we'll talk more about that in a second. So with a short-term action, typically you're addressing some type of immediate threat to human health and the environment. And removal actions at federal facility sites on the NPL are executed by that lead cleanup agency. Remember, we talked about lead agency before, be it DOE, DOD, or another federal agency identified as the lead for that site. So what type of removal actions are there? You have emergency response, where action is typically required within hours. For example, something exploded or blew up, and we need to respond now. There's not going to be enough time to do any type of paperwork, such as an action memo, which essentially lays out the plan of action to address that release, because it is an emergency situation. So understandable. If it's something that urgent, you're not going to have time to do paperwork. With a time-critical removal action, it is time sensitive, so action is required in a 6-month period. So not immediate, but you know, there is a sense of urgency around the need to address that release. And typically, you will have an approved action memo, which essentially is the document that identifies what cleanup action is going to take place to address that release. Notice that I said that is going to. So this should be in place before the removal action is conducted, because it's a non-emergency, time-critical response. So, for a non-time critical removal action, so often you'll hear those referred to as TCRAs or a non-time critical removal action. You will have more than 6 months of planning time available to be able to present which remedies can be considered, or which actions, I should say, can be considered to address this contamination before an action memo is signed. So, this resembles more closely a remedial action where you write. You have an RIFS, then a proposed plan that goes out for public comment. For a removal action that's non-time critical, you have an ECA, which is an engineering evaluation and cost analysis that goes forward for public comment. That public comment is considered, and then an action memo is signed, which actually identifies what action is going to be taken. One part of the regs that I would like to identify here is regarding EPA review of sampling and analysis plans for removal actions. I've mentioned that our lead agencies, the other federal agencies, are conducting removal actions under their own authority based on that Executive Order 12580. So that doesn't mean that the regulators are completely outside and absent from that process. Noting this citation here, the language that's highlighted says that if there's going to be environmental samples collected, the lead agency shall develop a sampling and analysis plans. And skipping to the end here, sampling and analysis plans shall be reviewed and approved by EPA. With this specific language, there's not the ability to give those, what's the right word? Essentially, EPA. Or the EPA administrator can't give that responsibility to another agency. Essentially, EPA needs to review the SAP. That doesn't go over to the lead agency because they're the lead agency because of the way this is worded. And I know this is sometimes not fully understood by people. I know, be it EPA or other agencies, it's important to be aware of that. If there is a SAP associated with a federal facility NPL site, be it for a remedial action or a removal action, EPA should be reviewing and approving that SAP. If you need more information on guidance for data collection at federal facilities, such as what the data we collect through a SAP, the UFP QAP guidance is very thorough, very detailed, and helpful to better understanding that process. And there's, again, a link to that in your participant manual. I want to point out one piece of guidance that has been issued. This is back from 1994, so it's a bit dated, perhaps, but it's something that we still follow in the program. And this talked about accelerating CERCLA environmental restoration at federal facilities. So it was developed and signed by EPA, DOD, and DOE in an effort to accelerate and streamline cleanup at federal facility sites through the use of removal actions. So that can be through non-time critical removal actions or other interim response actions. And looking at CERCLA Section 120 and Executive Order 12580, it really encourages this type of cooperative decision making. So that way, where we can streamline approaches, we continue to do so at our sites. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk more in detail about the type of removal action guidance EPA has and details on non-time critical removal actions. So, once a federal facility is listed on the NPL, that contamination should be addressed promptly, be it through early action, removal actions, like I've mentioned before, these interim remedial actions, all of these, those puzzle pieces we identified in the beginning of the webinar, all of those pieces are tools that can be used. When using removal authorities, I've mentioned that the lead agency is essentially conducting that removal authority under their own power. But that doesn't mean the regulator should not be included. It is important to continue to consult with EPA and the states and even the public to ensure that the action identified in that removal action is consistent with the overall cleanup goals for the site and that it essentially supports what will be the final remedial action for that site as well. When it comes to evaluating non-time critical removal actions, strong consideration should be given to those that will achieve results comparable to a remedial action but can be completed in less time. So, the non-time critical removal action, I mentioned that it requires an ECA and that has to go out for public comment, but it is a bit more of a streamlined process than what you would do for a remedial investigation and feasibility study, an RIFS. Typically, that those documents are not as lengthy, and so they can be conducted a bit more quickly. The scope might be smaller as well, so there's less complexity involved with that decision. When it comes to how the regulatory agencies are involved, again, I really want to emphasize that the EPA and state should have adequate participation in the development of these removal actions. It's beneficial for all of us to be on the same page as cleanup is moving forward. That way, there isn't a removal action taken and then an issue where the regulators are saying, oh, this is inconsistent. We didn't agree to this. You want to avoid that potential for dispute by working in a collaborative manner around the removal actions. The one part where EPA and the state play a role is really weighing in on whether that removal action will be consistent with the final remedy for that site. And that will also consider the anticipated land use for that site. So a lot of forward thinking that has to happen there. When it comes to ARARs, those applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements in a removal action, it's very important to note that the NCP requires removal actions meet ARARs to the extent practicable that contribute to the efficient performance of what will be the remedial action. So it should generally be practicable to meet those ARARs in a non-time critical removal action. If it becomes an issue or, for some very valid reason, it's not possible, though attaining those ARARs may be deferred to a later remedial action. So you would have that kind of language in the action memo that says these ARARs will be met in a later remedial action. So, and I know practicable is a somewhat subjective. People ask, well, how do you know if it's required or not? Well, you have to work through the process and collaborate with your site teams. Here is another memo just for you all to be aware of. This is between EPA and DOE, and it talks about an agreement on the approach for decommissioning surplus DOE facilities, identifying that it's consistent with CERCLA and can help streamline the approach. Essentially, it's an agreement that we'll use removal actions to bring down buildings. And now I'd like to hand it over to Cal to talk about RAOs. Looking at time, do we have time for any questions, Jean, or should we proceed?
I think we can. I think we can
Okay.
take a question or two here. And so, Emmy, we did have one attendee who asked, can you give examples of when it would be appropriate to use emergency TCRA or the non-time critical removal actions? I know you just went through that, but if we could
Sure.
revisit.
So for a time critical removal action, perhaps you have a subgrade underground structure that has been deteriorating over time. And now in your monitoring, you see that it's very likely this structure is going to collapse at any moment. So I would say you have justification to say that's a time critical removal action because it's going to go any day, any week now. We don't know when, but it's going to be soon. A non-time critical removal action may be, say it's the same structure, but there's no signs that it is going to deteriorate anytime soon. Then perhaps you have those 6 months to plan and you could move forward with a non-time critical removal action.
And a related question, if a lead agency, so for example, the DOE states that they're going to do a time critical removal action, but that action is taking longer than 6 months to complete, what is EPA's response or recourse? They noted that sometimes that they're aware that there's a difference and that one of these between the time critical and non-time critical, and that's the big difference is more public participation and feedback is required for the non-time critical. So if they're pursuing a path that does not involve more participation, but it's not meeting the timeline, what can EPA do?
Right. So I definitely can. I've seen this play out at different sites where we're calling something time critical, but it doesn't really seem to be that time critical, especially if it's taking so long to implement. Again, the regulator's role in these removal actions is really determining if that action is consistent with the final cleanup for the site. However, again, collaborating not only with your site team, but with your stakeholders, the public, having discussions with them, you could ask DOE to justify why they're calling this time critical and not including the public comment portion of this removal action process if it seems that the public would have interest and there does seem to be sufficient time. Just posing the question loudly may actually be enough to persuade the lead agency to reconsider and move from time critical to a non-time critical approach.
Okay. And then one quick point of clarification. Who is responsible for writing the RA or the ROD?
So when it comes to the record of decision, typically the lead agency will use their contractors to write the first draft of that ROD. EPA, as an agency conducting regulatory oversight, does not receive resources in our federal facilities program to write the ROD ourselves.
Okay. All right, I think right now we can carry on with the presentation, but I will let the audience know those were great questions. Keep them coming. You can submit them in the Q&A window at any time, and we'll pause again for another Q&A break shortly. So, Emmy, it's back to
Yep, and I'll hand it right over to Cal.
you. Thanks, Emmy. Okay, so now we're going to talk about remedial action objectives. Let me make sure my cursor works there. Okay, so remedial action objectives provide this direct link to mitigating site risks by specifying what will change in order to reduce those risks, right? So it articulates what the concerns are and what needs to happen in order to address those concerns. And remedial action objectives, or RAOs, they evolve throughout the cleanup process. So, in the feasibility stage, remedial action objectives are used to support the development of the preliminary remediation goals, or PRGs, and they may be a little less specific. By the time you get to the ROD, the process has evolved. Your remedial action objectives have been refined, and they're used to support the basis for the cleanup levels in the ROD. So, why are these RAOs important? As I said, it provides this link, this justification. From the exposure pathways and the receptors to the remedial action and specific remedy components. It's the thread that ties it together and justifies what you're going to do. And it explains exactly what the cleanup will change to address any risks that may be unacceptable. Okay, so in developing these remedial action objectives, we use a lot of these action words, prevent or protect from. This can be used for most RODs. We are preventing exposure. We are protecting from exposure to contaminated media. This the these are critical kind of goals of what the action is. Restore is another action word that we often see, usually associated with groundwater remediation goals, right? We want to restore groundwater to beneficial reuse, such as drinking water. Oh, sorry. There's one more down here. Minimize, reduce. This is also something that we can lean on if we need to. I think it's always better to prevent and protect from, but in some cases we are minimizing, we are reducing exposure. You can't get to zero, so you may be coupling minimize and reduce with some some land use controls or other institutional controls that can be combined to achieve the ultimate goal of protecting human health and the environment. I think what's important here is the process for establishing remediation goals for any media generally doesn't rely on only one thing, right? We are required to look at ARARs, right, that establish media cleanup levels. But we also need to think about calculated cancer and non-cancer risk, right? If there are multiple contaminants, the cumulative risk becomes really important, and an ARAR for a single contaminant may not be adequate. We definitely consider MCLs and non-zero MCLGs, or the goals that are typically lower than the MCLs. As I said, we consider the impact of multiple contaminants. CERCLA requires that we look at cumulative risk from multiple chemicals in multiple media. And we may look at other regulations from say, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Water Act, things like that. The important thing is that you consider all these different options in a process to kind of refine your shortlist to come up with what makes sense at a site-specific basis, right? So when you get to the proposed plan, you've refined your remedial action objectives. You have a shorter list of proposed cleanup levels and options for remediation, right? But this is also an opportunity to share with the public what the RARs are, what you hope to achieve, and why these different options might be considered for the final decision, right? And so we take community feedback on all aspects of the proposed plan. But this is also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to lay out to the public our thinking, our the thought processes that underlie kind of the decision-making process. And so, we can explain to them these are the sensitive populations that were considered in developing the remedial action objectives and the cleanup goals. So let's look at some examples. A little table is a nice way to kind of set this up, right? You have your purpose of the action. You want to prevent some unacceptable risk. You have the list of contaminants that you're dealing with. The media of interest. Let's in this example, it's surface soils. The exposure pathway. Incidental ingestion, dermal contact, inhalation, the receptors, future child and adult residents, and the cleanup levels that you've identified. And so you use this to construct your RAO. You're preventing potential unacceptable risk to future children and adults from long-term exposure through incidental ingestion of dermal contact with and/or inhalation of surface soils with contaminant concentrations above, safe levels for these chemical contaminants. Another example with groundwater, the purpose of the action is to restore that you have your contaminants, they may be VOCs, for example, media of interest, groundwater, exposure pathway, drinking water, receptors, people drinking water, and the cleanup levels may be MCLs or other health-based values. And so you piece that together for the RAO. The goal is to restore groundwater to its beneficial use as a potential drinking water source by reducing groundwater COC concentrations to meet federal and state drinking water standards or other health-based goals. Third example, source control. Maybe your objective is really just to contain the contamination. So the purpose of the action would be prevent migration. Your contaminants would be listed. The media of interest may be DNAPL and residual contamination in this particular source area. The exposure pathway that you're addressing is a migration pathway. It's really like the fate and transport part of it. Receptors, in this case, it's the clean groundwater you want to prevent from being contaminated. And the cleanup level would be specified, could be specified in various ways. So in this case, the RAO is prevent COCs in source areas containing DNAPL and residual contamination from migrating to the groundwater outside of the source areas by maintaining an inward water gradient for over 10 months of the year. So that prevents the water from flowing out. You want to keep it pulled in. Okay, next, I think this goes back to Emmy for rods.
Perfect. Thank you, Cal. All right. So let's get into records of decision. These are very meaty documents, but they serve a specific purpose, actually, four purposes. So let's look at those individually. First, it's going to certify that the remedy selection process was carried out in accordance with CERCLA and the NCP. That's one primary function. Secondly, it summarizes the technical rationale and background information, meaning you shouldn't copy-paste your RIFS into the ROD and then also include your selected remedy. It should be a very concise summary of that information. And the ROD should also provide technical information which outlines the remedial action objectives that Cal was just talking about and the cleanup levels that are to be met. And lastly, and perhaps this is given the least amount of attention, the ROD is really intended to be a key communication tool for the public on knowing which remedy was selected and why it was selected. So all of those are very important jobs or roles that the ROD has to fill. When it comes to selecting a remedy, there are nine criteria that are used to evaluate the remedial alternatives. Pet peeve of mine is when I hear the term, oh, the nine CERCLA criteria. Actually, the criteria is not in CERCLA. In the NCP is where the nine criteria are identified. So just a pet peeve, if you could not refer to it as the nine CERCLA criteria, I would greatly appreciate it. But rather the nine criteria used to evaluate remedial alternatives. We have our threshold criteria, which absolutely have to be met. The remedy being selected has to be protective of human health and the environment, and it also has to comply with ARARs, those applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. I should say the exception there is if an ARAR waiver is issued, then that can apply. The next set of criteria that are used are the primary balancing criteria. So you have long-term effectiveness. How is this going to function going into the future? The reduction of toxicity, mobility, and volume of the contamination. Short-term effectiveness, which I think short-term effectiveness in descriptions and RODs that I've read over the years can get a little sticky, as in, well, where is the worker safety for those implementing the remedy? What kind of risks are they being exposed to in that short-term time? And often, well, if we didn't do anything, then the workers would be exposed to less risk, and that would be good. Okay, but then how is the long-term effectiveness going to be impacted if we don't do something more active now? Just things to keep in mind when writing down the evaluations using these criteria. Next, we have implementability. And last, we have cost. So, yes, cost is a criteria that's considered. Simply note, it's not the only criteria that is considered. The cheapest alternative is not automatically the one that is selected. And also, the most expensive alternative is not necessarily the one that is selected. You're looking at all of these criteria and trying to get the best trade-offs between all of them so you have a balanced justification to which remedy is going to be selected. Lastly, we have the modifying criteria. So with modifying criteria, we're looking at state acceptance. Is state on board with the remedy that's being selected? Oftentimes in the record of decision, there will be a section where the state can write their acceptance or additional language that they want included in the ROD. And then we have community acceptance. So community acceptance is really brought into the process when a proposed plan goes out for public comment. During that time, it's a formal process of receiving public comment on the proposed alternatives, not only the preferred alternative identified by the lead agency and sometimes also the regulatory agencies, but all of the remedies that were considered during the RIFS, as far as those that were put forward for consideration. With community acceptance, I have often seen people think, oh, well, that doesn't really matter. The public really can't make a difference. We already chose what we're going to do, and that's what's going to happen. Why are you even asking for public comment? We know you're not going to change anything. I have seen community acceptance of a proposed alternative really make a difference. So please keep that in mind. The process to include public comment on the proposed plan is very important. That's where the public can really say whether or not they agree with the preferred alternative being identified, whether they have major concerns with that alternative. And it can be enough information. If there's significant concern, the lead agency, often with help from the regulators, have to write a response in the responsiveness summary section of the ROD, which we'll discuss in a second, saying either why those concerns are addressed or identify a way they're going to modify the proposed alternative to be able to address those concerns. I have seen this play out where changes, adjustments were made to a preferred alternative because of what the community provided during the public comment period. So it's not a throwaway criteria. It is very much part of the process in choosing a remedy for a site. Getting into some of the nuts and bolts of a record of decision. In the 1999 ROD guidance, which is heavily referenced throughout this entire webinar, yes, 1999 is a bit dated or seasoned, whatever word you want to use, but it is still the guidance that EPA uses, refers to when it comes to how RODs should be laid out. In that guidance, we have three parts identified: the declaration, which is very short in comparison to the rest of the document. We have part two, the decision summary, which essentially has all of the information, your site background, a summary of the technical information, risks, your remedial action objectives, which are very important in laying out which remedy you ultimately end up selecting through the analysis and your selected remedy. So for me, when I look at a ROD, I tend to jump to the selected remedy section to see, oh, well, what was the remedy that was identified here? What is to be implemented? And the responsiveness summary is the third part of a ROD. I just mentioned that. This is where the agencies respond to stakeholder comments, public comment that was received during that public comment period on the proposed plan. And it can also be an area in response to those concerns to talk in more detail about any technical or legal issues that arose during that consideration of that information. So responsiveness summary, very important because you're essentially closing the loop with the public on how their comments were considered and what changes, if any, their comments had in the remedy that was ultimately selected. Okay, going to switch gears a bit and talk about interim actions. So when we talk about a record of decision, sometimes you'll hear the phrasing, oh, it's a final ROD or it's an interim ROD. I don't believe we have in EPA guidance the term final ROD really used. Interim RODs, we do have reference to that. In my mind, though, we essentially continue to look at our remedies through 5-year reviews. So it's never really done. In my a final ROD may not be the final decision that's made for a site or for a grouping of operable units, but Jargon aside, let's look at interim actions. So when you're determining the need for an interim action, you're going to make that determination during the scoping of the remedial investigation and feasibility study. So the lead agency may determine that an interim remedial action is appropriate. With the interim action, it's likely going to be limited in scope and it addresses specific areas, geographic areas, or media that will be addressed by a final site or operable unit record of decision. That is the key part of this slide is interim actions need to be followed up by that final ROD. Some reasons for taking an interim action may include, you need to move a little more quickly than a 5-year RIFS to take action to protect human health and the environment from a more imminent threat. Or perhaps you're instituting some type of temporary measure that's going to stabilize the site or prevent further migration of contaminants, especially in groundwater, for example, or further environmental degradation. So that interim action, again, will likely be smaller in scope and look at specific media to implement an action that will ultimately support the overall or final remedial action that will be taken. As I just mentioned, you can have interim actions that are identified for a set of operable units. Those operable units may have many, dozens or hundreds of waste sites, or they might be smaller in scope, depending on the size of each of those. And an interim action might be a component of a final ROD. Again, there's the term final ROD, which I'll be using throughout this section, or other portions of the site. Again, think of it as a ladder. This is one step to get through the cleanup to that final cleanup stage. All interim actions must be followed by a final ROD, that it won't be the last word. Even if through the interim action you've addressed all of the risk and there's no longer risk, unacceptable risk posed by the contamination at that site or in that grouping of operable units, you would still need to issue a final ROD that essentially would be a no further action ROD, identifying that the risk has been addressed based on this. No further action is required at the site. So even if it's for no further action, you need that final record of decision to be issued. And I should say for removal actions, the same goes. A removal action at a federal facility MPL site cannot be the only or final cleanup response for a site that needs to be captured in a final ROD for remedial action. I don't think I mentioned that earlier. With the interim actions, again, our goal with all of these responses is to protect human health and the environment. When it comes to ARARs in the decision document for an interim action, you are looking at those ARARs that are specific to the action being taken. So, specific to that geographic area or media or actions being implemented for that. You're not looking, anything outside of that scope will be addressed in the final record of decision. So, a couple of examples of what may entail an interim action. Installing extraction wells to restrict migration of contaminated groundwater with the intention of remediating the aquifer at a later time. So, we don't want that plume of contamination to continue to spread. We're going to put in some extraction wells to control the flow path of that contaminated groundwater, and we'll look at treating the groundwater at a future time. But the interim response is to stop the flow so the plume doesn't continue to grow. That's one example. Another example would be providing a temporary alternate source of drinking water with the intention of later remediating an aquifer. So you're stopping the exposure there. You're addressing the risk to human health. And lastly, constructing a temporary cap to control or reduce exposures to contaminated soil until a subsequent action is taken is another example of what you might find in an interim action. These specific examples, I believe we took them from the 1999 ROD guidance. So definitely, if you haven't downloaded that to your laptop or printed it out, if you're a little more old school, I like the paper sometimes, highlights, flags. My 1999 rod guidance is well used, to say the least. So when it comes to interim actions, what are the pros and what are the cons? Not every agency feels the same about them. So as far as pros, you can really focus in on a limited scope of action. Those temporary measures can help stabilize your a site or OU grouping to prevent migration of those contaminants, so you have a smaller problem to deal with in the future. Also, with an interim action, you can justify not meeting all of your the applicable and relevant or applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements if it will become part of a remedial action that will attain or waive as necessary those ARARs. Also, in implementation of an interim action, you're likely going to gather a lot more data, and that will help better characterize the remaining contamination so that your final remedy might it might be easier or a more informed selection because of those activities. As far as cons, again, as I've mentioned a couple of times, those interim records of decision need to be followed by a final ROD. And some agencies view that as an ineffective use of resources because, let's face it, getting an interim ROD signed feels like the same amount of energy resources as a final ROD signature. And it can take a comparable amount of time for an interim decision versus a final ROD to get signed. And it can limit the ability of a lead agency to transfer property since not all remedial action needed for that site or grouping of OUs has been completed. So a couple of things to keep in mind on the pros and cons. Just to speak for EPA very much supports the use of interim rods. But if you are on a site team working with another lead agency, just keep in mind that that agency might view interim rods in a different way. So it's good to work with your site teams and identify what's the best way to proceed forward and essentially slice up your cleanup because our sites are so large and complex. We really do have to do it bit by bit to be able to complete a site. Here we go. Yes, I have definitely seen more interim rods happen at DOE, Federal Facility MPL sites, and less so at Department of Defense sites. Now let's talk about that waiver I mentioned earlier, the Interim Action ARAR waiver, which is listed in the NCP. So this interim action waiver can be used when an ARAR cannot be met as part of the interim remedy, but will be attained in a final site remedy. So an interim action, it's interim, right? So it's not designed or expected to be final, but it identifies the best balance of trade-offs on the alternatives that were considered. So although a preference for treatment will be addressed in a final decision, any interim action that supports that preference for treatment is desired. We want to move cleanups in that direction. So to make this a little more real for everybody, I have a quick example from the Hanford site on a groundwater interim ready that was implemented. So here you can see we have the Hanford site in South Central Washington, and this was from the center portion of the site where we have a number of contaminated groundwater plumes, or we did. This image was taken back, I believe, from 2010. So just using it as an example. From these plumes, you can see in the lower half, there are some technetium plumes and also uranium plumes that are identified there. So for this interim decision, it was really looking at those two contaminants and where they were located. In the central portion of the site, when Hanford was active and nuclear reactors were being run in the attempt to make plutonium for atomic weapons, there were large-scale contamination that happened at the center portion of the site from discharges to essentially to trenches, unlined trenches that allowed a lot of liquid waste to percolate through the soil column down to groundwater. So here again, I mentioned specifically technetium and uranium. For the interim action, that's a lot of groundwater to cover. I think it's about 7 square miles or more of contaminated groundwater shown here. So not being able to address the entirety of the contamination in one go, but recognizing that there were very, very high concerning levels of technetium-99 and uranium, an interim decision or remedy was identified as needed to stabilize and reduce the plume, essentially, for these two contaminants. So here on the next slide, we can see that the ARAR for these two contaminants, one being uranium, was 48 parts per billion. And for technetium-99, it's 900 picocuries per liter. But it was recognized we're not going to be, a we, the Hanford site team, was not going to be able to meet those cleanup levels. So we're not looking at a final ROD, acknowledging that areas that had 10 times the cleanup levels were considered for this interim action, wanting to reduce the contamination levels there in an effort to support the over, I should say, final remedial action of remediating the entire aquifer. So the ARAR waiver, because this is an interim decision, was that those high concentration zones of 10 times the cleanup levels for uranium and technetium-99 were part of this action. Those are the areas that we're focused on to be able to reduce contaminant mass levels there. And essentially, that interim action removed quite a bit of contamination. It was considered a success, but it wasn't the final answer. There were still plans for that long-term remediation to occur and the acknowledgement that future records of decision to implement a final remedy were still necessary. But in the meanwhile, this is one step that got them closer to that goal. Okay, switching gears away from that example, briefly, I just want to point out that there is some guidance from 2006 about the requirement to use an interim remedial action report. You may have heard it referred to as an IRACR. That actually is no longer a requirement. It was superseded by EPA's 2011 guidance on the closeout procedures for national priority list sites. So it just says, okay, you don't have to use an IRACR, that interim remedial action closeout report. It could be a different document, but it doesn't have to be an IRACR. I think there was still this understanding for a number of years that, oh, we have to issue this document. Not necessarily so. It might be that information is included in a different type of report, or ultimately, EPA will be looking for that information in a final closeout report towards the end of the cleanup process. Just wanted to make that clarification. We've gotten less and less questions around this at EPA headquarters, but it still does come up sometimes. With this example here, specific to our groundwater cleanups, just wanted to show, and this is from the closeout guidance that I was just referencing. With on the bottom half, this looks at federal facility sites. So you have the implementation of your remedial action. Typically, before going into an O&M phase, we'll issue a operating successfully and fun I'm sorry, Cal. Cal, help me out if I'm getting it wrong. In federal facilities, we refer to it as operating properly and successfully, I believe. And so that report can be issued between the remedial action and going into O&M. Another thing to keep in mind, the state does not have any cost requirements when we move into the O&M phase at federal facilities. Those are still the obligation of the lead agency to meet. All right. So now I'm going to hand it back over to Cal, and she'll tell you what to do if you need to make a change to your remedy after the ROD.
All right. Making changes post-rod. Okay. So there are different types of changes you can make after the ROD is signed and implemented. And it depends on the scope of the change, the performance, and the cost, right? It will fall into one of three buckets. It could be a non-significant or minor change. It could be a significant change or a fundamental change. And each comes with varying levels of documentation and community engagement. So, for example, if the change is minor, right? You're just tweaking a remedy. A memo or a note to the file could be sufficient documentation for this purpose. If you have a significant change, that would warrant an explanation of significant differences, which is a more robust document. And then if the change is fundamental, then you may need a ROD amendment. So the more changes that the more fundamental it, when the changes are fundamental, you definitely need to engage the community for public comment. Although it may be useful to consider this even for an ESD, depending on the site. Let's start with the ESDs. Okay. I don't like these the slides that come in one bullet at a time. For the ESD, okay, these are significant changes affecting the remedy, right? So what you need to do in the ESD is describe to the public why there's a significant change needed. What's happening with the current remedy? Sometimes the remedy may need to be adapted. Sometimes the remedy just may be kind of peaking, right? So it depends. It's very site specific, and we have to be very clear describing what the problems are. And ultimately, we have to make sure that the revised remedy complies with the NCP and the statutory requirements of CERCLA. So, what I the analogy that I like for this is apples to apples, different color apples, though, right? So there's the difference is significant. It's a different color of apple, but not so much that that you need to revisit the nine criteria, for example. You could a side-by-side comparison of the original and proposed remedy components could suffice in laying out the significant differences. What's the same, what's different, and why? This is required to be made available to the public by publishing the notice of availability and a brief description in a major local newspaper, as well as adding it to the administrative record. Now, if it's a high-profile site and the community is very engaged, you may want to do a bit more. There's nothing preventing you from going out there and talking to the community about this. So, one example. Your remedy is in place, or you realize while you're doing this that the volume of hazardous materials is much larger than you realize. So you have to expand the footprint, for example, of the remedy, and that increases the cost. So that might warrant an ESD. Another example is, let's say you have a treatment train in place and you need to add another biological treatment or substitute out a biological treatment for airstripping in order to make the remedy more effective, right? So this is a bit more than a tweak, but it's not a fundamental difference. The same basic pump and treat approach is being used, but you're modifying elements of the treatment train. So that change could be considered significant, but not fundamental. So let's look at the rod amendments, the fundamental changes. So this is your apple to orange comparison, right? So there's that. This means that there are major changes with respect to scope, performance, and cost. So for the portion of the rod being amended, new nine criteria analysis is generally required, including a new analysis of ARARs, as well and public engagement. So note that if this could be only a portion of the rod, the original rod that needs to be changed. That's okay, right? The other activities associated with the rod being conducted can continue on, and we're just focusing on this one component. And for this, again, you have public participation and documentation procedures. You might have the public comment period. You may have a public meeting, et cetera. Oh, that was a slow cartoon. So the bottom line is the involvement, the community involvement for rod amendments is similar to the rod. So let's look at some examples. So let's say that you have selected as a remedy in situ soil washing, and you realize because of the characteristics of the soil, this is not going to work, and you have to come up with a different remedy. That is an example of a fundamental change that requires a rod amendment. Another example is during the 5-year review, you realize that the containment remedy is not protective, and you need a more active response, treatment, or remediation. So a new remedy must be selected that will meet protectiveness requirements, resulting in unanticipated costs for the site. This is laid out in a rod amendment. Okay, Jean, I think we have a quiz question.
We absolutely do have a quiz question. So I am going to take over the view here and pose a question to the audience. I'm going to click a button and a poll window is going to launch on the screen. So you all should see a new pop-up. If you can't read everything in that pop-up, you can resize it and move it around. And if for any reason you don't see the pop-up, we have the question and the scenario on the slide. So you are absolutely welcome to simply read that and then type your response to this poll question as a message in the Q&A. So I'm going to read through this scenario here where we ask you to consider three types of post-record of decision or ROD documentation changes exist. Which one of these is a fundamental change in the ROD and thus requires a ROD amendment? Would it be A, a new technology enhancing the selected remedy was brought to the lead agency and now they want to use it? Would it be B, the selected remedy is not removing a contaminant efficiently enough and the lead agency has decided to pursue an alternative remedy? Or is it C, the cleanup level noted in the ROD is no longer protective enough and needs to be changed? So simply click the answer to the left or the circle to the left of the answer that you think is the right one, A, B, or C, and then hit the submit button. It looks like about half of you have cast your vote. Again, if you have any technical challenges with the poll or you don't see the pop-up, you can just as Liz is doing, you can share your responses in a message in the Q&A. But it does look like you're leaning towards one answer right now, but there's a little battle happening as I'm watching these responses come in. So I'll give you all just a few more seconds to consider these three types and to select the one that you think is a fundamental change in the ROD and therefore requires a ROD amendment. So go ahead and take your best guess, and then I will close the poll here in 3, 2, 1. All right, about 2/3 of you voted, and about a little over half of the audience, Cal, picked B. That the selected remedy is not removing contaminant efficiently enough, and thus the lead agency has decided to pursue an alternative remedy. That's what about half of the audience said was a fundamental change. However, C, talk about a third of the audience's selection. So about a third thought it was C, but a little over half thought it was B. What's the right answer? Okay. There you go.
Sorry. So if the right answer is B.
Woohoo!
So good job. But I will say that I have seen some very kind of vibrant debates among RPMs over whether a Rod Amendment or an ESD should be selected. So this is something that could require some discussion and debate. And it's similar along the lines to when Emmy was talking about the time critical removal actions for the non-time critical removal actions. Sometimes you need to talk this through to weigh, what is better for this particular site at this particular time. So, not easy. Okay, let's see. The next section covers 5-year reviews, impacts on remedies, and NPL site deletion. Okay, so 5-year reviews are required. Anytime waste is left in place at a site. So, one thing I love about 5-year reviews, and I think everything should be subject to 5-year reviews because things change, right? Your understanding of the science changes, the site conditions might change, people move in and out of the area and might be using resources differently. And so the 5-year review is this opportunity to go back and make sure that the remedy is protective by assessing kind of the underlying assumptions and conditions that were the basis of the ROD. And the lead agency is responsible for ensuring that that any follow-up actions, any issues, recommendations, follow-up actions identified in the report are completed. And EPA, the regulators, either concur with the protectiveness determination or provide independent findings, which are then reported to Congress. So this is kind of a big deal. And note that federal facility 5-year review training is available. Okay, so for each operable unit, before the final RODs for the site are in place, you're making these protectiveness determinations on separate sites or operable units. And your options are protective, will be protective once the remedy is completed, protective in the short term. However, in order for the remedy to be protective in the long term, follow-up actions need to be taken. Not protective unless the following actions are taken, or protectiveness cannot be determined. So the remedy, the protectiveness is deferred. So when you're reviewing the 5-year review, when you're developing it or reviewing it, if you're the regulator, it's helpful to consider the different components of the remedial action objectives, right? So these are your risk drivers, the media, the pathways, receptors, the contaminants that might be present, the cleanup levels, the land use, and the purpose of the action. Are we preventing? Are we minimizing? Are we eliminating? Are we restoring? And note that over time, all of the conditions and assumptions that are underlying our remedial action objectives and basis for the ROD can change, right? So the receptors could change over time. We could identify new and additional contaminants, like what's happening with PFAS right now. Suddenly, the contaminants you thought were the main concern are not the main, not the only ones that are a main concern, and it that has consequences for the protectiveness of the remedy, right? The land use could change. Often, at federal facility sites, sometimes we have housing and developments kind of creeping up closer and closer to the boundary. So that poses that a change in potential land uses and receptors. So you need to go back and examine all of the different assumptions and conditions that were in the original RA to see if they still stand. And the 5-year review gives you a very nice framework for doing this in a very systematic way. So, I think we want to call out those conditions that may lead to a not protective protectiveness determination. So there's an immediate threat is present, an exposure pathway that we just identified that's currently not being controlled, and people are being exposed right now. The migration of the contaminants has changed and broken through. There's a preferential pathway, and people and or the environment are being exposed. Potential or actual exposure is clearly present. There's evidence of exposure. There's failures of institutional controls, for example. Or there could be new cleanup levels that have been introduced since the rod, and the remedy can't meet those new cleanup levels or aren't meeting the new cleanup levels. So there are exposures above the risk range. So those are all examples. Those are major red flags. Those are things you want to that need to be addressed as soon as possible. So, if the remedy is not protective, then the recommendations to address protectiveness should be identified. And if the 5-year review, the remedy is not performing as designed, that may actually trigger consideration of an ESD or a ROD amendment. What do we need to do differently to get it to this point? And I do want to say state that it's not just these recommendations. Issues and recommendations do not just come out of situations where a remedy is not protective. If we determine it's protective in the short term, the institutional controls are holding for now, but in order to be protective in the long term, more work is needed, then that could trigger the ESD or ROD amendment as well. So for site deletion, the NCP identifies criteria. No further response is appropriate. The documentation of cleanup actions and decision-making at the site is complete. The institutional controls are in place. The operation and maintenance is not considered, oh, op sorry, operation and maintenance is not considered a response. So you may have O&M ongoing, but the remedy could effectively be complete. All RAOs must be achieved before a site can be deleted from the NPL. So it has to pass, a number of tests in order to say, okay, we're done here. And Jean, back to you.
All right, so we are going to launch our second poll. So I will click that button and launch the poll. A new window should appear on the screen. And I'll let everybody know this is a scenario that I will read, but it should be also visible in that pop-up poll window. Again, please go right ahead and resize the window if needed so that you can see everything. And then we'll ask you to simply check the box or the circle next to the answer that you think is correct. Is this a true or false statement? Is the remedy still protective in this scenario? So in this case, Site A is preparing for its second 5-year review. The ROD was issued in 2005. However, the cleanup level for the primary contaminant of concern, or COC, became more stringent in 2012. And based on that new cleanup level, the existing COC concentration exceeds the cleanup level. Because the remedy is still performing as designed and the RAOs were met, and therefore the institutional controls are no longer in place, the other federal agency concludes that the remedy is still protective. So, from your perspective, based on today's training, is the remedy still protective? True or false is the statement, the remedy is still protective. Is that true? So, I'll give you just a few seconds. About a third of you have cast your vote. If you can't see the poll, you can always type it in as a message into the Q&A. And I'll give you just a few more moments here quickly to think about it, cast your vote, and then we'll talk through the correct answer. It looks like about half of you have voted. So, go ahead, take your best guess here. And let's see. All right, looks like answers are starting to slow down. So I'm going to close that poll here in 3, 2. Drum roll, I can see you with bated breath. Drum roll, please. 1. All right, let's end the poll. I'm going to share the results with everyone. And 3/4 of the audience said that the correct answer is false, that the remedy is no longer protective. So, Cal, now that we've seen that most of the audience thinks it's false, what is the correct answer?
Yeah, they're right. The remedy is no longer protective and needs to be adjusted. And whether that's an ESD or a ROD amendment depends on kind of the technical details of this. But one thing we have to get really good in doing, and this is, not just other federal agencies, but EPA states, is going back to communities and saying, based on the knowledge we had in 2012, we thought, we understood this to be safe, or acceptable, or an appropriate target. But now we know differently. We've learned more, the science has evolved, and we need to change or modify the remedy in order to get it up to today's standards. So we just have to learn to say that. I think we're all saying that a lot these days because the science evolves rapidly and we need to keep up. And that means going back and changing things. So not a fun message, but it's one that's very common. And I think with that, I'll hand it back to Emmy for the summary.
All right. So we've talked a lot about different decision documents, be it your records of decisions, interim or final RODs, post-remedy changes like ESDs and ROD amendments, and how removal actions can play a role in cleanup of a site. So hopefully you have found this information informative. I believe we have some Q&A we can go into now. Jean, are there questions from the group?
Oh, there are questions from the group. So let's dive right in. I'm going to start first with a question here that came in regarding the RACER or the RACRs. So they commented that this is, you had been talking about taking a site off the NPL. Can you sign a RACER or RACR and move a site into long-term monitoring with institutional controls, even if not all of the RAOs have been met yet? For example, a natural attenuation site that will eventually result in meeting of the RAO.
So I think the question here is referring to partial deletions of a site from the NPL. In the Federal Facilities Program, especially, we have embraced this approach because our sites are so large or can be so large and so complex to be able to show progress where cleanup has occurred and that resource, that land is available perhaps for a property transfer, reuse, or redevelopment, things like that. Typically, what we see is a remedy has been implemented, and the surface to maybe whatever it may be, 10, 15 feet below ground surface has been remediated. But there's a long-term groundwater remedy in place that will maybe take decades to achieve. We've seen partial deletions for the land portion of the site and those operable units and gone forward with that while still keeping the groundwater resource as part of the site where that long-term remedy is being implemented and O&M is taking place. So yes, we can do partial deletions at our federal facility sites, and we actually encourage that to occur so we can show progress is happening.
Okay. Do ESDs and ROD amendments still apply if the site has been deleted from the NPL?
So if a site has been deleted from the NPL, we have said all the REOs have been achieved. And then new information comes to light that perhaps brings into question whether what was conducted at the site is still protective. That can change things up. We might have a situation where it is no longer protective from the contamination that did remain. Like the example we just went over, right, Cal, where it was fine and now we have new information and we have to look back at the details. Did you want to add on, Cal?
No, I was just going to say that's a great example. We don't walk away from NPL sites, and so it and things change. So it's a
Yes.
marriage.
NPL deletion is not like your get out of jail free card. You stay married, I guess, is to use Cal's example.
Okay. Okay. We have a question about interim actions. And one of the attendees wanted to know, would focusing on a specific problematic contaminant be a good use of an interim action?
It could potentially be helpful to look at that, carve out that scope. If it is particularly complex, or if it poses a very high risk to the public or the environment because of the nature of that contaminant, where you want to address it more quickly than perhaps the remediation of the entire geographic area. Cal, did you want to add on?
DOD recently committed in a memo to supporting interim actions for PFAS. So that's an area of focus that they've chosen to emphasize.
Okay. All right. I have another question, and this one is getting into it's a three-part question. So bear with me. I'm gonna read through this one. For remedies involving the creation of wastewater, remediation-derived wastewater, like water that accumulates in excavations or landfill leachate, and then it goes to an off-site permitted WWTP, wastewater treatment plant. What level of information is needed in that decision document versus a work plan? They wonder, does the decision document need to include evaluation of the treatment technologies and capacities of the permitted WWTP, and then include an evaluation of NPDES permits to make a CERCLA determination?
So in my experience, dealing with federal facility sites where there was a landfill leachate was collected and sent to a permitted facility, the decision to send that, the decision document where that was identified as leachate from this landfill will be sent to X permitted facility only said that it would meet any pre-requirements for pre-treatment requirements before sending that liquid or leachate to the permitted facility. And then from there, once it enters that facility, it essentially has to meet and be treated through what's in the permit there. So you don't have to do, at least in my experience, this NPDES other type of evaluation. You're simply relying on the permitted facility to meet its requirements as laid out in their enforceable permit.
Okay. And then related to that, if the remedy includes on-site water treatment, like a modular system, is it then acceptable to include the particulars of the treatment in the remedial action work plan rather than in the ROD?
Ah, that's a great question. I have seen records of decision where it was clearly specified that X resin was going to be used, X number of wells was going to be drilled, and so on. When you put that level of design detail into the ROD, you are obligated to meet those. So 12 wells is 12 wells. If it turns out you need five, the ROD says you're going to put in 12. So design specifics really make sense to be left to the design phase, and you focus on your remedial action objectives and how the remedy will meet those remedial action objectives, not specific to design. You don't want to paint yourself into a corner, essentially. You want the flexibility to allow your remedy to adapt to the changes that you'll see as you implement our long-term remedies, especially, and not have to go back and to use the phrase open a rod when you could have avoided it in the first place.
Okay. And then last question in this multi-part question, a no action rod that documented all action taken via interim actions, but LUCs are still needed. So land use controls. Is that a no action rod or a LUCs only?
I will say, just a heads up, if EPA headquarters sees a LUCs only rod, we will hone in on it very quickly because we want to better understand. In this case, let's say numerous actions have been taken through early action, removal action, interim action, and now all that really remains is maintaining the land use controls. Okay, there's a justification there. If there is not that history of cleanup at the site, then there's going to be a lot of questions asked. Did you want to jump in, Cal?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the no action rod. I don't like the terminology for that. Because you are taking action, you have institutional controls. And it no action has connotations later, like post rod, that can be problematic. And I see a lot of older rods have the no action, were labeled no action rods, but they were indeed, they did, they had institutional controls or, related. So I mean, yeah, if it comes to me and I'm reviewing it, I'm gonna challenge that. But I'm headquarters, so.
Yeah, really think about that. No further action rod, meaning there is no unacceptable risk at this site and no land use controls, any kind of additional action is needed. That's where that phrase really makes sense. With land use controls only rods, again, we want to ensure that a active cleanup response has been implemented. And if land use controls are all that remain, then it makes sense to proceed with a rod like that.
Okay. All right. How about are there significant differences between interim action ARAR waivers and technical and practicability waivers?
Ah, yes. TI waivers. just a side plug, we do have an archive training on ARARs if you want to really get into the details of ARAR waivers. So an interim action is its own type of waiver. A technical and practicability waiver is a separate type of waiver that are both acceptable. So they are different. Interim action, again, you're arguing or justifying that the interim action is appropriate because it's going to be a step in a larger, more final remedial action. Technical and practicability is getting to a justification that you cannot implement a remedy because it's simply not feasible. It's impracticable to be able to implement it. So those are two different types of waivers. I will say interim waivers are pretty straightforward. That doesn't require a huge additional headquarters review. Technical and practicability waivers do require additional EPA headquarters review. It goes through the region EPA region technical and practical their TI waiver coordinator, who coordinates with our folks here in headquarters to review those packages to determine if they can move forward with that proposed waiver. One other thing to note, any waiver that's proposed as part of a remedy has to go out for public comment with the proposed plan so that the public can also weigh in on what they think about that proposal.
Okay. All right. How about RAOs and their format? So RAOs need to be written statements. The questioner says that they have a federal facility site where in the draft FS report, the OFA did not include written objectives such as, quote, prevent, restore, et cetera, but rather a table matrix of COCs, media, and exposure pathways.
I'll start with this. So one of the biggest issues that I see as a document reviewer in headquarters, that document authors seem to forget their audience. and that their audience is not just their coworkers or the RPM. So it's really important. I'll flag if you're not making the case for me, if you're not spelling this out, you're thinking and explaining like these are the conditions. This is what we're concerned about. This is what we're going to do about it. And this is how it's going to, where it's going to get us. Then, I'm going to flag that. I'm going to want that rewritten. So, I think it like constant reminders that, the audience may not be familiar with this. And they certainly don't have all the knowledge and information that you have. And it could even be a new RPM coming on board 5 years down the road. You want to explain your thinking. It's really important.
All right. Let's take a couple of, well, one last question here about adaptive management. So I don't know, Emmy or Cal, if you could talk a little bit about adaptive management and any role that it plays in RODS.
Sure. So I'll start with adaptive management. That was a phrase that was hot in EPA a couple of years ago. You see it less so, but honestly, it's all part of the same CERCLA process. So when you're conducting your RIFS, characterizing the nature and extent of contamination, you're gathering data, you're doing sampling, you're better understanding what's happening at your site. With that information, you start looking at remedies. So throughout the entire process, you can always reevaluate what remedies have been selected and how they're performing. So say through the RFS process, you start to better understand your contamination and you end up adding technologies that need to be considered. That's great. You're responding to the information, the data that's being gathered. Once you have a ROD in place and you're going through your O&M phase, your 5-year reviews, perhaps more information comes out. And that's where Cal was saying, you consider, do we need to look at an ESD or a ROD amendment for this remedy because of this new information? All of that really is part of adaptive management, and it can be considered at any point in the CERCLA process, be it your RIFS or 5-year reviews. The use of removal actions and revisiting through a final remedial action, again, is being adaptive to the data as it comes in, and you better understand your conceptual site model to be able to select a cleanup and also ensure that it continues to be protective. Did you want to add, Cal? Sound okay? All right.
Okay. Well, we have a few observations that came in earlier, and I just want to read them off to get your input on it. So, one participant noted early on in the class that it might be helpful to note that there are instances where the HRS score at a federal facility does not actually lead to listing on the NPL, yet the remedial process continues. In other words, listing on NPL is not a requirement to continue with the response action. Okay. So, I'm.
Absolutely. Yes, thank you for that clarification.
Sure. All right. And then I have another statement here. The term final ROD has been a point or has become a point of confusion for some OFAs where they really mean to indicate a ROD for a final remedy at an OU or site, not the final ROD for the entire base or federal facility. Just wanted to point that out as a note for the group. And I'm seeing nodding heads and smiles. So I don't know if either of you wish to add to that statement.
No, I just think it's accurate that I even had it in the slides, a final ROD, trying to distinguish from an interim ROD, which is using an interim waiver for the remedy that's being selected. But yes, final ROD is complicated because it can mean different things to different people.
Okay. I see one that snuck in here. I think this might be related to a scenario. Should bottled water be considered a protective remedy? And they ask short term and long term.
Cal, do you have thoughts, Cal, on that?
I mean, that's a really tough one,
Yeah.
right? Because and of course I'm thinking about PFAS. I don't know if the questioner was thinking about PFAS. It's science evolves. Their FDA regulates bottled water. there's probably going to be a change in how FDA does that. I don't know when, I don't know how, what, but even I think we're all kind of stepping back and saying, is handing out bottled water like the most appropriate interim action right now? So it's definitely something for discussion at multiple levels. And I think that's really all I want to say on that.
Yeah, definitely a
It's a
gray
tough
space.
one.
There's not a
It's a
bright
great
line.
question.
Yeah, great question.
Okay. We had a question regarding PFAS. Now that PFOA and PFOS are designated as hazardous substances before a remedial action is implemented, is EPA requiring that Superfund sites be investigated for PFAS now with that regulatory change?
A couple things to say. Okay, so now it's covered by PFOA and PFOS are covered. They're hazardous substances, so they're covered by CERCLA. Prior to this, they were considered pollutants and contaminants. I'll give you to answer that question, I'm going to give you an example of how we're approaching this on DoD sites, DOE sites, all other federal agency sites. So if I get a 5-year review, I am looking at the site uses and contaminants that are present that may be a signal for PFAS. Is there a metal plating site? Is there AFFF, the use of the PFAS-containing firefighting foam? Is very common, right? We want to flag these sites and we want to say, have you looked for PFAS? Have you considered it at this metal plating site? There may have been in the mist suppression component, may have resulted in a release of PFAS. So we are asking these questions. And we're trying to do it systematically too. There have been a number of peer-reviewed papers that looked at patents on how PFAS is being used. It's easy to review those papers and make a list of the types of uses that are most likely to have resulted in releases to the environment. And when you look at sites, you can start asking these questions. And I think it takes time to kind of mobilize and get systems in place, but yes, CERCLA covers PFAS. So
All right.
I
Well,
hope that helps.
I think that did. I'm looking at a few questions that are in the queue that are very site specific about particular scenarios and some sampling questions. And so, Emmy, I think perhaps right now, given those types of more site specific ones, shall we move to wrap up and what people might be able to do if they do have site specific questions and maybe they're looking to have a dialogue or help get some input?
Sure, let's do that.
Okay. I think you all have one more slide. Am I wrong? No. Oh, usually there's a contact slide. But Emmy, if they have additional questions, what could some of our attendees do?
So, if it comes to policy or guidance questions, anyone in my office at EPA headquarters would be happy to help. For site-specific questions, we really encourage you to work with your site teams. If you're not with EPA, that your EPA counterpart can help reach out to subject matter experts on those site-specific questions for additional discussion. We at headquarters don't like to get ahead of our regions when discussing those site-specific matters. And for my EPA RPMs, we have a Federal Facilities Coordinator for each region that can help you with any question you may have. Always feel free to reach out to them and they can send either provide you the information or point you in the right direction for help at your federal facility sites.
All right, excellent. Well, if it's okay with you, ladies, I think I'm going to go through some final reminders here and we'll wrap up today's webinar. So I want to thank both of you for taking time to share your expertise on our session today. And I saw several messages come into the Q&A with people complimenting you and thanking you again for today's session. So if you joined us a little bit late, just a quick recap that today's webinar is part of an ongoing series that's part of the Federal Facilities Online Academy. So there is a collection of 11 webinars that will be hosted open to the public on Kluin. We just completed our September 12th session, and our next session will take place in October, where we'll look at RCRA and CERCLA integration. So if you haven't registered for the upcoming sessions in the series, I encourage you to visit us and sign up for the rest. Remember, these webinars are open to the public and are part of a larger Federal Facilities Academy training. There will be a 3-day classroom training that is open to federal, state, and tribal regulators. And if you're able to participate in that in-person training, so you complete all the webinars and qualify and complete the in-person training, you can receive an Academy certificate. However, if you can't take the in-person training, you are still welcome to take any or all of the online trainings, either live or by watching recorded versions. And I'll cover how you can get certificates of participation for the recorded or live online versions here in just a moment. I do encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or Kluin website, and please be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. I send that out on the first of each month, where we highlight resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. Now, for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, there is a participant manual already posted on the seminar homepage. That homepage URL is shown in red on the slide. It's the same website that we sent you to when registering and in our confirmation and reminder emails. That website will be active from today forward. So if you happen to be watching the recorded version, you can still go to the URL shown here, and you'll be able to scroll down or use the plus and minus icons to collapse and expand various sections, and head over to the webinar slides and references section. You'll be able to access something called the Participant Manual. That manual contains the slides as well as some detailed notes and links related to our training today. So I encourage you to download that for future reference. There is also an area on that seminar homepage for the feedback form. So if you scroll down and expand that section and you share your feedback with us based on today's session, there is a box at the bottom of the form that if you check and certify you are here for the entire live delivery or you replayed the entire archive, as soon as you check that box and submit the feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a certificate of participation that you can download or print out. I will email a copy of that to you as well, but those oftentimes get caught up in junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to download it from the pop-up screen. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location, meaning that colleagues joined you and watched from your computer, simply send your colleagues over to that seminar homepage and they can share their own feedback, get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register independently. I simply ask those that do register, make sure you share that link to the homepage to your colleagues so they can give us their thoughts and get their own certificate of participation. And then, of course, if you are one of the lucky ones who's watching the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now, above my head in the upper right corner in the archive version, there will be a button that will take you right over to that seminar feedback form where you can fill it out to get a certificate based on your replay of the archive session. So again, the seminar materials are posted. Information for our speakers is also up there. Links to that feedback form will be available to share your thoughts and get your certificate of participation. And with that, that's the end of my reminders. I want to thank everybody who joined us for today's session. We hope that you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time, and you will join us on a future webinar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.